Okay, well, let's start at the beginning, a little bit of background information on you. Could you state your full name, please? Your full name.
My full name is Edmund L. Morris.
And your date and place of birth?
I was born in Halifax on the 4th of February, 1923.
Okay. Could you describe your educational background before you came?
Yes, as a child, I lived on Brunswick Street in Halifax, and I went to St. Patrick's School. My mother and father were practicing Roman Catholics, and I am a practicing and full supporter of Roman Catholicism. I went to St. Patrick's School on Brunswick Street, and then to St. Mary's College High School, which was located on Windsor Street. And so I'm an alumnus of St. Mary's, but only of the high school. I went to grades, if I recall correctly, 10 and 11 at St. Mary's College High School. That was in 1936 and 1937. And then I went to Dalhousie University and graduated from the university came back to St. Mary's as an employee in 1963.
Well, let's talk about those years that you were at St. Mary's High School. What was the size of the school when you were there?
The building on Windsor Street, of which there are very many photographs in the present St. Mary's University archives, and the cornerstone of which is at the Student Union building, in the little frontispiece, the late Russell Lowndes went up one day and found it. God rest his soul. And we put it up on a plinth right outside the Student Union building. It was a very small building, and the instructing staff were members of the Christian Brothers of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And they were outstanding educators. The whole school was sprung at 10:30 a.m. for a common recess. Our recreational area consisted of two handball courts, upon which, of course, even if you played doubles, no more than four people could play, and an old, old battered rink with natural ice in it, not artificial, which was, of course, called the Roarum instead of the Forum. That was our principal recreational outlet. We walked where the present St. Patrick's School on Quimple Road, that was in fact the field with a cinder track around it. And at recess you all walked around the track or through a baseball or through a football or something in the center of the field.
I see. What were the students like, your fellow students like?
What was the...
Was it a completely Roman Catholic population in the school?
I can't tell you that. You could you would better find that in archival resources than my memory. Certainly, it was an institution with a heavy involvement of Roman Catholicism. Mm-hmm. It was an institution where if you were a Roman Catholic, your faith would be upheld. I'm sure we had others there, and no harm was done them, and no attempt at conversions. But it was certainly an institution where, if you were a Roman Catholic, there was opportunity to keep your faith and profess it and practice it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a chapel and the Christian Brothers of Ireland, who presided over class in a full-length soutane right down to the floor, and the black cummerbund around it, and their principal disciplinary weapon was a handball, which was lodged in the right-hand pocket. And if you were out of line as a student, the handball came out of that pocket in an underhand motion and whipped down the length of the classroom at you. Boy, you had to duck fast. I don't know how they ever got their hand into the pocket, back out with the ball and threw it. That was their disciplinary weapon. There were also some laymen. The late Dean of Commerce at St. Mary's University, Harold Baisley, taught commerce. Among others, Jack Lynch, and there were other teachers as well.
What were the academic programs like?
But I was only in high school, so, you know, I really can't remember. There were fellows ahead of me, but they were the exalted seniors. We were just high school students. Mm-hmm. There were very few options. You took what was offered. There are still, even today, in 1993, some educators who fancy that there should be fewer options at that level. Education, more compulsories, and you get a better education. We're now teaching people how to fix automobiles, but sometimes we don't manage to get any values built into them.
Yeah. Okay, so when you came back to the school as an employee in 1963, what position did you first come in?
I was elected a member of parliament for Halifax in 1957, 58, and 62. And in 1963, I did not share entirely the policy views of the then leader of the party that I supported, the Right Honorable John Diefenbaker, and I didn't run in 1963. And I came to St. Mary's University. I heard that there was to be an opening for a position of assistant to the president. The president in 1963 was Father Claire Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R. By 1963, and indeed years before that, the Christian Brothers of Ireland had given way to the priest of the Society of Jesus, known as Jesuits. And the Jesuit fathers directed St. Mary's University. Father Fisher was a Jesuit father, still is. And he was also rector of the Jesuits in Halifax. St. Mary's was then located at our present campus, Gloresbrook. There was one building, the front building, the McNally Building. We were unisex, boys only, and they went to classroom with neckties and shirts. And the Jesuit fathers lived in the south wing of the McNally Building. And they were, as I say, the president of the university was simultaneously the rector of the order. That is, he was the principal Jesuit, primus inter pares, among 20 or so Jesuit fathers. And he had the rectorship of the order as well as the presidency of the university. We had, in 1963, when I joined the staff in July of that year, 30 years ago this month, there were approximately 630 students, as I recall. You knew every one of them by sight, and probably half of them at least by first name. And the president's duty, gladly borne, was to talk frequently to the students. If you were a student, you were invited to come to the president's office. And he would go over your scores with you, and he'd ask you how you were getting on. And if you needed help, he'd get it for you. It was very, very personalized. And I was then at St. Mary's until 1974, when by that time, the university I became in, with the passage of time, I was assistant to the president in 1963. And in 1969, I was appointed vice president administrative. We had a different title for it then. It was called finance and development. it was among my responsibilities to help raise the money to build the buildings that are here now, mm-hmm. many of them, the older ones. And in 1970, the Jesuit president of the university, Father Labelle, left the university in sometime in the spring, and he put a note under my door that he was leaving, literally, physically, and that I should take over and run it for the balance of his term. And I did that for a couple of months, and then I was installed as interim president while the search committee looked for a president of the university. I'm not an academic. I happen to think I'm a scholar in politics, but I'm not an academic. And so I acted as interim president of the university. At about that time, the university became a fully public university, and it had also, two or three years prior to that, it had reached a decision to admit female students. And that was a major decision.
Yeah.
And what a grand decision it was.
Mm-hmm.
But looked at in the future, instead of looking over your shoulder at it in the past, it represented a dramatic and progressive move. It took a lot of courage to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The university was growing. It had one attribute which is not, I can emotionalize about it, but I'm more concerned to be intellectualized about it. It is an unique quality at St. Mary's University, and that was that the student was the center of the university, not the administrator and not even the faculty. That the student was the center of the university, and that everything stopped to help the student. And you will find particularly evident among the more senior faculty members, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that the juniors don't do it as well, but you'll notice that it's inherent in the senior faculty members. Earlier this morning, I was in a faculty member's office, now that I think of it, and while we were chatting, three students came to the door. He dropped everything with me, as he should have. Went to the door, brought the student in, and handled the student matter. Student comes first, not second, not third, not fourth, first. And that was a unique quality at St. Mary's. And it's harder to do the bigger you get, but we still try to do it. If a student comes in any office that I know of in the university and he or she needs help, you drop what you're doing and help the student. I mean that. If it's a simple thing like directions on campus, or if it's a serious thing like I have no money, I haven't even got money to buy my meal, you drop everything and you find the money. I'm not urging students to do that, but I am saying I've never known a student to come to St. Mary's who had the desire and the commitment to get a degree. A way was not found to get them through, including putting your hand in your pocket to do it. And that's, to my mind, that's so integral. I mean that. It's exaggerated by brevity, but a university is a willing, open-mind student and a skilled, dedicated teacher and a teeter board and a book. And all the rest of it is just add-on.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest of it is add-on. You know, you can make it as big as you want to make it, but that's the essence of it. It's an open mind, a student seeking to know the world in which they're going to live, and a teacher who's got the capacity and dedication and knowledge to transmit it, and an intellectual resource represented by a book. And if you have... I was reading documents last night from Yale University, 4.5 million books in the library. There's so much knowledge, but the principal thing in the university is to get a student and a faculty and a body of knowledge together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it works.
So how did the resources at St. Mary's grow over the years?
In 1963, just about this time of year, just at the time I came to the university, I could easily find the date, we turned the sod for what is now the Burke Education Center. That was our first library. How proud the university was that this was the first building that the university had built. The Roman Catholic Episcopal Corporation, the practicing Roman Catholics of the Archdiocese, had financed the front building, the McNally Building, named for a very dedicated former archbishop. But here was a new building, the Burke Education Center, that Father Fisher had, with the help of some laymen, but had all been pretty well accomplished by the time I joined hands in July 1963. They had raised the money and going to build their first building. And we turned the sod. Curiously, contractor found running water right in the corner of the building where it was originally sited. It was supposed to have been further north towards Inglis Street. You know the front lawn there? The library was going to be closer to the sidewalk. When they dug the hole, we ran into Gorse Brook.
Yeah.
And Gorse Brook flows throughout most of South End Halifax, empties into the harbor ultimately, where the first residential tower is at the corner of Tower Road. There used to be a magnificent pond which was frozen over in winter. People used to skate there. So the first building was the Burke Education Center, which was our library. My recollection, which I haven't researched for many years, is that it was about two-thirds of $1 million. We then moved to build the first two floors of the science building, the alumni arena, the student center. We built, I've forgotten, two floors, I think, and subsequently put another addition on. Mm-hmm. Then we went into the residences. And high-rise residences were real leaps of faith, you know, 17 stories, that type of thing. And we had to raise funds for that, and goodwill, help from the Episcopal Corporation, consideration, charity from them, and one thing and another, it got to the point where then in the presidency of Dr. Owen Carrigan, now in the history department at St. Mary's, he became the president after my interim presidency. He built a library, and then Dr. Osman built more buildings and the sports field. So those were days when all universities were building. We had, as I mentioned to you, in 1963, something like 600 students. We now have 8,600.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Amazing. So how did the academic programs at St. Mary's grow and develop during those years?
I can speak in general terms of that, but of course I'm not the authority because I'm not an academic. We were always identifiably strong in commerce. Engineering was taught at St. Mary's, the preparatory course, and then you went for your final degree to the Technical University of Nova Scotia, as it is now. It was then called Nova Scotia Technical College, now TUNS. And as the student, it was both cause and effect. As the student numbers increased, the academic programs increased, and as the academic programs increased and enriched, students came. Students still come to St. Mary's because of their estimation that they can get a good education at St. Mary's. Mm-hmm. We have a strong education faculty, and it did a magnificent thing in the 1960s and 70s, and it's still doing it today. It upgraded all of the teacher certificates in the public school system. They all went from a lower license to a higher license by coming to St. Mary's and getting postgraduate or graduate up training. And that ripple effect of upgrading the teachers who then go on and inculcate students is an enriching factor throughout the whole school system and will be for generations. And that was an important measure. St. Mary's always had a dedication to disabled students. It was not patronizing. It came out of a profound belief that every student is made in the image of God and that each human being is a human miracle. And we found that disabled students couldn't get to university, so we made an effort to get them to university. I have the fondest memories of the boys up in what we call the North Wing. That's the north wing of the McNally building. There was a boy there by the name of Rogers from Yarmouth. His father ran a furniture store, well-known, salt-of-the-earth local citizens, and he was in a wheelchair. And the other boys were just exemplary the way they looked after him. They took him out to every party they went to. They took him everywhere they went. They took him to every class. And out of that grew the overhead pedways that connect the campus. When we built the residences, the thoughtfulness was make sure that the boys don't have to go out in the snow with a wheelchair. Spend money if you have to. They're human individuals. They're miracles. Get them to class. And that has grown into that magnificent Atlantic Resource Center for Disabled Students. That ethos grew into that. Mm-hmm. Under David Leitch's brilliant leadership there, it's part of the essence of St. Mary's, and that is that the student was the center, and disabled or not, we take account of them. I remember on one occasion, if you're anecdotalizing, and when somebody came to me and said to me that his son had a particular mindset difficulty. If you placed him in a pen or pencil in his hand in a written examination, he quivered all over. He couldn't handle it. He just could not handle it. And the result was he was literally, the door was barred to his advancement. It's nothing today to have oral exams, but in those days it was quite unique. And that the university, I said, leave it with us, we'll see what we can do. The professors met and they said, we've no difficulty. The test is whether it's got into his head, not whether it got into his hand. We'll give him an oral exam. And I see that boy today. He's a chartered accountant and a brilliant chartered accountant. He's overcome that adolescent difficulty, and he's made a life for himself and his family, and they're fine people, partly because St. Mary's reacted. I'm just quoting that particular example for disabled students. Yeah. Yep.
Any other changes or developments that you remember? Any other changes or developments that come to mind?
Well, gradually as we grew, we put flesh on some very, very thin bones. As with any human growth in an organism, we grew to have faculties and disciplines and new areas, astronomical observatory was a pioneering venture named for the late great Reverend Father Burke Gaffney, who was a little leprechaun of a man, and those of us who believe in sainthood, he's a saint, just a tremendous man, world famous astronomer. So we pioneered in that area. We always had a good football team. We told the boys that there were two ways to go through life. You could go through life winning and go through life losing, and as long as you did it fairly, it was a better way. It was a lot more comfortable going through winning. And we taught them to win. And I want to tell you that it wasn't just, I've heard it, and I always resented it. I heard it occasionally referred to as the jock school. This is by other, particularly other institutions that don't have anything else to praise themselves for. The provision of wholesome recreation for 8,600 students in an urban environment is no small responsibility. Better they play football than some other things they could do. And yes, we taught them to win, play together, and try to win. We used to win national championships. There's a curious syndrome about that. We often, obviously, you need the best facilities you can get, and we're going to go on trying to get the best facilities for them. But it is a curiosity that when we had virtually no facilities, we used to win national championships.
Mm-hmm.
The old gymnasium was under the McNally building, the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So after you stepped down as interim president, what did you do after that?
I think Dr. Carrigan became president, if I remember, in 1971, and I reverted to my vice presidency. I took over full-time again as vice president administration, or as it was called, finance and development. When the university became a freestanding public institution, we had no underwriters. There's nobody out there signing notes for us. Other universities, not that far away, have accumulated deficits. St. Mary's doesn't have any. St. Mary's it got students out with fine degrees, and it didn't owe any. There was nobody backing it at the bank, and it was occasionally very, very, very tight and very difficult. And in 1974, I left the vice presidency to run and then serve as mayor of the city. And in 1980, I left there and went to the provincial government. And in 1988, I left the provincial government as a cabinet minister. And in 1989 or 1990, the present president, who's probably the best president in the country, in my book, Dr. Osman and Donnie Kelleher asked me if I'd come in and give the university a little hand with what we call planned giving. And I do that on a part-time basis. And I'm a very fortunate human being. St. Mary's means a very great deal to me. And just to be on the campus is a pleasure to me. It's been a part of my life, very important part. And many of the professors were here when we're still here. There's a note from one of them today, this morning, on a personal and intimate basis. They were here when I came, and they're still here or just about retiring and that type of thing. And there's some fine professors. Jack McCormick, Art Monahan, those two men are a historian and a philosopher. They're internationally famous. Bill Bridgeau in science. If I start, I'm sure I'll forget some. But these are fine people. And the Jesuit fathers who were at St. Mary's were just outstanding. Just outstanding. We all, every day we talk, the older hands among us, somebody will remember an incident about some Jesuit father, some lesson we learned, even in our maturity, middle age, they could teach us lessons. And they're just outstanding. Father Hennessy and Father O'Donnell and Father Bill Stewart, these are outstanding men. Father Larry Murphy, Father Jim Murphy, here I go again, Father. they were outstanding. Now, there's still some Jesuit fathers here, but they are declining both in absolute numbers and certainly as a percentage of the faculty, because we have, I believe we have a total of, if I'm not correct, 550 faculty and staff. When I came in 1963, the faculty portion alone, I think there were 36. You knew everyone. Father President used to spend a significant amount of time walking down the corridor, dropping into professors' offices. Today, there's just a slight chance that if you're not careful, you may meet a professor somewhere in the city and not ever have met him on the campus or her. You have to be constantly alert as the university grows. It has to grow if it is to serve its students. And it's cause and effect, as I mentioned earlier. But you try to, as much as you humanly can, to keep that imperishable value of individual contact. That was what made it different. And when parents were either making decisions for their children or participating with their children in making the decision about university, the bottom line was often, go to St. Mary's, they're more attentive to the students. They still got the small school capacity to react individually to a student. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important. Everybody at St. Mary's thinks it's important. It's just important to me that I keep saying it.
Yeah.
Because it is. We have to keep constantly aware of that. That was the uniqueness. There's no merit in getting bigger, you know. There's no intrinsic value in size. Big, small. It's what you do with the size that you have and how you serve people who are, and how it responds to people in it. And yes, it's difficult. The university is run without any deficit. We don't have any accumulated deficit, and we don't accumulate one year by year. And that's not easy. And I mean by that, it not only takes effort, but it takes a great deal of skill by those who have who've been entrusted with its management, so that you need it all the way from the board right through to the staff.
Well, that's about all I wanted to cover. Anything you think of anything else?
Right.
That's good.